Welcome to Group Therapy. I'm licensed psychologist Dr. J.
And I'm licensed clinical social worker Kristen Gingrich.
And I'm licensed psychologist Dr. Jessica Rabin.
Well, glad to have you here. We're talking all about schizophrenia, and we're so excited to have special guest Cody Green later on the show to share his experiences having schizophrenia. So settle in, take a seat, and welcome to Group Therapy. Yo, I'm excited to dive into this topic. I think there's a lot of misconceptions that exist around it. But I'm curious, what have y'all's experiences been treating schizophrenia or seeing schizophrenia within this professional context?
For me, it's next to none. So when I worked acute inpatient, I had a couple clients. And then since being like independently licensed, I have seen, I think, one patient ever in the hospital that had schizophrenia, but like I can count on one hand in a clinical capacity how many individuals I have seen with this diagnosis.
What about you, Justin?
Not much at all. Yeah, I'm right there with Jess of like next to none. I think there's been some people I've seen in crisis situations that it's possible that that was what's playing out there, but never in a sustained manner where somebody had the diagnosis.
I worked in community mental health. So I worked with a good chunk of individuals with the different types of schizophrenia diagnosis, because there's several different types. I also worked in substance use, and that tends to be a common diagnosis in that realm. So whether it's psychosis or things like that. But I do have a good chunk of experience working with individuals diagnosed. I wouldn't say it's like a niche. I wouldn't say like I would be a go-to person for someone. But I definitely have a lot of experience. It's a diagnosis that really interests me because it is, Justin, like you said, it's really misunderstood. And it's very, very stigmatized in the way that it is usually presented in the media. And that was something like, even when I started in the field, like even I didn't know much about, and now like kind of learning what I have learned, like I have such a different viewpoint, and my eyes kind of have been so opened to this diagnosis that for many, it can be really scary for them. Absolutely. But for a diagnosis that is so personal and so internal, for a lot of people, because, you know, the things like hallucinations, auditory or visual, we on the outside, we're not seeing these things, but they are, these are things that are real. And I know we'll dive into that, but, it's definitely a diagnosis that I have a lot of interest in.
And we'll never know for K-10 because she's not here, which I should have said at the beginning, but I'm glad you're starting to broach the topic of like, what is it we're exactly talking about when we talk about schizophrenia? So yeah, what are these diagnostic criteria / symptoms that really categorize?
Well, per usual, I have my DSM up if we want to go through
just for the win.
Yeah, no, because I exactly like you all have said, I think it's very misunderstood. So going through the diagnostic criteria for A, two or more of the following each present for a significant portion of time during a 1 month period or less is successfully treated. And then it says at least one of these must be one, two, or three. So one is delusions, and we can go into what each of these things are here in a moment. Two is hallucinations. Three, disorganized speech. So this could be like frequent derailment or incoherence. Four, grossly disorganized or catatonic behavior. And five is negative symptoms. So a lot of people think of like diminished emotional expression, like completely flat. for criterion B, for a significant portion of the time since the onset of the disturbance, level of functioning in one or more major areas such as work, interpersonal relations, or self-care is markedly below the level achieved prior to the onset. Continuous signs of the disturbance persist for at least 6 months, and this six-month period must include at least 1 month of symptoms that meet criterion A, and may include periods of prodromal or residual symptoms. Schizoaffective disorder and depressive or bipolar disorder with psychotic features have been ruled out. The disturbance is not attributed to the physiological effects of a substance. And if there is a history of autism spectrum disorder or communication disorder of childhood onset, the additional diagnosis of schizophrenia is made only if prominent delusions or hallucinations, in addition to other required symptoms. And then there's a lot of like specifiers, but really at its core, those delusions, hallucination, disorganized speech, disorganized or catatonic behavior, and negative symptoms.
A lot of terms. What is a delusion? How would you know something's a delusion?
I kind of wanted to ping this to KBI without putting her on the spot, just because she has the most experience.
Oh my God. I am so bad at defining things.
Like, I think of like persecutory delusions. Like, people are out to get you. It's like this belief that you have that is not based in reality. But yeah, I don't know if that's actually the proper definition.
So there are, according to this, there are five different types of delusions when it comes to schizophrenia. There's paranoid, right? Which mm-hmm. is the most common that we see, right? You know, the FBI is listening to us. Someone has bugged our house. People are talking about us with no proof. That's probably the most common delusion that, I have experienced with clients. The second is delusions of grandeur, or grandiose delusions, are false beliefs that a person holds lots of power or is extremely important. So that is another one. I haven't had much experience with that one. They believe that they're a celebrity or a famous person, that they're a god or a messiah. They have special powers like telepathy or things like that. Delusions of control. They believe that somehow or someone or something is trying to get inside their mind and control their thoughts and feelings. And, or they feel that someone else is controlling them. They believe maybe someone has implanted a computer into their brain. They think that their doctor or the news is trying to do something. Aliens are stealing their thoughts, things like that. Delusions of reference. This is, they believe unrelated events are actually referring to them. Everyday events like listening to music, watching TV, or seeing a billboard on a drive home. That can be one. Delusions of eteromania refer to someone believing that another person or several people are in love with them without any evidence. Again, the most common one I see are probably the delusions of control or the paranoid delusions. Those tend to be the most common that we do see in schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think those different categories are interesting. Some of them I had never even heard of before, but I think it's because it can be any strongly held belief where there's plenty of evidence to suggest otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But just like in OCD, when we can have a lot of different types of and subtypes of intrusive thoughts, any form or flavor can exist out there. It's interesting to see and hear about these categories that are more common of what you see.
Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of people either confuse delusions and hallucinations or think they're the same thing. So, you know, hallucinations, a lot of people think of visual hallucinations, like seeing things that aren't actually there and real. There's auditory hallucinations, that's hearing things that aren't there or real. There's also tactile hallucinations, which I think a lot of people don't know about or realize. So this like one I think of a lot is like feeling like bugs are crawling on your skin, or in my limited experience working with this population, like feeling like a presence, like somebody is touching them, grabbing them, things like that. I don't know if I've missed any other types of hallucinations, but visual, auditory, and tactile are the ones at primary. There are olfactory, actually, now that I said that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Olfactory hallucinations where you're smelling something.
Yep.
Is there taste hallucinations?
Yeah, there are.
There are. Oh, all of our senses.
Any senses, yeah. Yeah, which again, I haven't heard of this before, but since this is an area I have, you know, much experience or expertise in, it makes sense to me that any sensory experience, you know, could mm-hmm. be involved.
Yeah. Yeah. And then disorganized speech. I feel like that's, I want to say self-explanatory, but obviously we're in the mental health field. But I think of things like just like incoherent speech. It like does not make any mm-hmm. sense. I've also seen this in writing. Like mm-hmm. individuals will write mm-hmm. down things, like fill journals in. Either mm-hmm. you can't actually make out what they're writing or like what they are jotting down has no logical sense, coherence. Catatonic behavior. Does anybody want to take that?
That's kind of like they're there, but they're not there. They kind of lose sense of movement. They lose like, it's kind of like they're sitting there and they're existing, but they're just not there. It's like their mm-hmm. their entire system has shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the negative symptoms. And I think of the like diminished emotional expression, like really just like mm-hmm. flat affect, but not flat. Like a depressed flat affect, like literally like not there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you all think of any other things with negative symptoms.
Yeah, I think also like the emotionlessness, like mm-hmm. in a voice, like just the complete flat presentation without mm-hmm. typical arousal or expression.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's important to think about all these things within the constellation, like you had mentioned, that these are happening most days for at least a month.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I think, like all things within mental health, you know, people can have a flat, you know, expression because of depression or burnout mm-hmm. or trauma. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of these individual symptoms can exist, of course, which I know we're going to get into, but that's why talking about like having two or more of these most days for at least a month. And then what the nuance of the second part, I think, was lost on me. It's got to exist for at least a duration of 6 months. There's some six months.
Yeah, so signs of the disturbance persist for at least 6 months.
Yeah, which makes sense.
So, and that 6 month period must include at least 1 month. So like if you only had 1 month of symptoms and then there was like no signs after that, isn't that brief psychotic disorder?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I also mm-hmm. think too, I mean, in that diagnostic criteria, there were so many rule outs, like explicitly in the diagnostic criteria. Yeah. Like it can't be, you know, major depressive disorder with psychotic feature, bipolar disorder, mm-hmm. autism spectrum disorder. And KBI, you might be able to talk to this more than I can because of your experience working with it. But I feel like schizophrenia is one of the mental health conditions that many people try to rule out.
Yes.
Other things before putting a label on, like at least in the hospital, if anybody comes in with any type of hallucinations, delusions, we are ruling out any type of organic medical mm-hmm. condition first.
Absolutely.
You're assessing for major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, things like that. Before we hit record, I said, I've seen hallucinations more so in major depressive disorder with psychotic features than I have in true schizophrenia. And, you know, mm-hmm. one, I think that's good due diligence, but two, I think it's because like you said, KBI at the beginning, it's a highly stigmatized and like heavy diagnosis. And we don't want to just label somebody with schizophrenia, because a lot of these symptoms could be attributed to a lot of other things, organic causes, especially like medical illnesses.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially I always say too, that delusion part, specifically paranoia, that is that can be attached to so many other diagnoses that sometimes we so quickly, like the general public so quickly goes to schizophrenia, when the reality is like, we even postpartum, it is common for it is actually pretty common for those increased paranoid thoughts. And postpartum psychosis and things like that. And you are right, Jess, right? We want to rule out, and with any mental health diagnosis, we do rule outs. We want to rule out the quote unquote less invasive, less severe diagnoses before we go to the bigger ones, because they are so big. And there is a piece that is, a lot of it, I believe, has to do with the stigma and discrimination that is associated with schizophrenia and the reality of the long-term consequences that a lot of individuals experience because of their schizophrenia. And I think that, you know, ruling out is appropriate in any diagnosis, but specifically, like, I know, I don't think I actually diagnosed schizophrenia ever in my practice. If an individual came to me with schizophrenia, they have most of the time, it's because they've been hospitalized many of times and it's been a consistent diagnosis. But even if someone was coming to me with paranoia and things like that, like a lot of times I was sending them for evaluation to help rule out some of these other things. Substance use specifically. If a client has come to me and they're an active substance use and they're experiencing hallucinations and delusions, like, I mean, just mushrooms give you hallucinations. Tripping balls on acid can give you hallucinations. It doesn't mean that you have schizophrenia. And so, you know, we want to rule out some of those things beforehand.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because we know at least 50% of people who get a diagnosis of schizophrenia also meet criteria for some sort of substance abuse, which... Yeah. You know, it becomes a real interesting interplay, of course, because we know so many different substances can cause hallucinations and mess with our reality checking. But we also know people self-medicate for so many different struggles and difficulties that I think that's such an – it becomes difficult to see – you know, what's at play here. And I agree. I think this is why schizophrenia, it takes a lot of data and time to arrive at the diagnosis and rule so many different things out that you just can't get to as quickly in a snapshot.
Yeah. Well, and Justin, you talked about self-medicating. Over 2/3 of people who deal with psychosis do not receive the specialized care that they should be receiving. They're not receiving that specialized mental health care. So whether it's psychosis, brief psychotic disorder, any of the versions of schizophrenia, because there's a couple different versions of it. We're kind of talking about it in generalities. More than 2/3 of individuals do not receive specialized care. And it is one of the higher diagnoses that struggle with med compliance. Because of a lot of times the delusions and the paranoia and things like that. So, you know, self-medicating becomes the norm because they don't want to hear the hallucinations. And I know we haven't really dived into, you know, the hallucination part and what that may look like for some people. But for some people, like, their hallucinations are really scary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, I always joke that, like, I had a client one time say, like, was chuckling because I was sitting in a puddle, because that was what their hallucination was showing. And then there are hallucinations out there that are telling people to harm other people. And it telling them over mm-hmm. and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, KB, I love that you brought up like how scary the hallucinations can be and the harm, especially to self or others, because approximately 5-6% of individuals with schizophrenia die by suicide and about 20% attempt suicide. And we see suicidal ideation a lot because of what those command hallucinations, like commanding the individual to do something to hurt themselves or someone else. My understanding of it is it's typically auditory hallucinations that are the command hallucinations.
Yeah. The statistics say like that their life expectancy is drastically lower than the average mm-hmm. person because of not only like the suicidal risk and that type of stuff, but you know, the increased health risks, the increased all of that. But the command hallucinations can be really scary just because it's mm-hmm. over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. You know, they've been described to me as mean. And one of the things like I want to say about hallucinations, and I have never experienced a hallucination in my life, but how it's been described to me, how I've seen simulations, this isn't the voice in your head. This isn't sounding like that internal narrative. This is as if mm-hmm. someone is standing over my shoulder and I turn and there's no one there. And they're whispering in my ear. There is a very clear, because I always will talk about, like, when I talk about hallucinations, people are like, well, yeah, I hear voices in my head all the time. Mm-hmm. No, it is drastically different. You know, our mean internal narrative, we know that that's us. Mm-hmm. The sound that they are hearing, it feels like there is someone over your shoulder and you turn and there's nothing. And that's a constant. We did a very interesting, at my old job, we worked with the local police department because in my community, I worked in a very rural community. There was a lot of individuals with schizophrenia. The police department wanted to be educated. They had grant money. So we did this training. And basically what we did was we gave these Walkmans or CD players or something to them with earbuds, and they had to go do daily tasks with these earbuds in. Some just got like, it sounded like whispers and it was just like, right? It just sounded like mumble jumble. Some got, you know, they were not so nice. Sometimes they were nice. Sometimes it was just nothing. They were just talking about nothing. And some got really mean and aggressive, commanding voices. And when they came back in, one of the things that they said was like the commanding voices, like it was hard. Through all of it.
Mm.
But the commanding voices, like you're just sitting there trying to pick out bread. And like the one guy said, he was like, some woman walked up next to me while a voice was like trying to convince me that this person was trying to hurt me. And like, it didn't know that, it just happened to line up. And it's like, my body was responding to that. And I just remember like, they knew that they were listening to a hallucination. And how hard that is to navigate. So that's one thing to like kind of say about that, is it's not just like hearing our internal narrative.
Mm-hmm. I love that you clarified that, because I think a lot of times when I've assessed, when people are like, yeah, I hear things that other people don't hear, I'm like, well, is it from like, is it your voice or is it external to you? And they're like, oh, well, it's like my voice in my head. I'm like, okay, well, that's very different than you hearing something external to you.
Yeah.
What a interesting experiment. It made me reflect on how there's so few of those that we can really do to get for other people to experience mental health things. Right. I was thinking about that. It's such a interesting thing for someone to experience, to be like, wow, that was really hard, while trying to live and go about your daily life. So yeah, transition a little bit, like what are the treatments? We know, like KBI said, 2/3 of people don't even get the treatment that exists, but what are the different treatments that we know can help?
A lot of it is medication. it's one of the diagnoses that has a lot of 30-day injectables to help with med compliance. Most of my clients that I had worked with over time, they would have some form of an injectable and then some form of oral medication. Those medications have come so far, but they are heavy hitter medications. For some, it can make most of the symptoms disappear, and some of the symptoms might pick up nearer to the end of that month, nearer to the injection date. But for some, it just takes an edge off, and then they learn how to kind of cope and manage. I know Cody will talk kind of how he manages it, but a lot of people do like self-regulation, self-checking, things like that, to help manage their hallucinations or delusions. But a lot of it is medication management.
Yeah. I love that you brought up the injectables, but also, like, I think you said heavy hitter, because there's first generation antipsychotics, second generation. The first generations had horrific side effects, like tardive dyskinesia, which is a movement disorder. But even the second generation, like, I see antipsychotics used more like off label, but like they can make you really catatonic and tired and you're not experiencing hallucinations, delusions, but you're also not functioning well. Yeah. But from like a outside medication standpoint, I mean, I know like research will tell you like therapy can help you with thought patterns and things like that. What I've seen more is like family therapy, going off of our episode from last week, of just like how to support and provide psychoeducation, like social skills training, vocational training, like how can somebody who is adherent to their medications learn skills to function as independently as possible?
Exactly. And I've seen, psychotherapy produce results when it's like focused on being able to notice, label hallucinations, label when something's a delusion. And what we know in general, and this is across the board with mental health difficulties, is if anything helps lower your stress, it's likely going to help severity of symptoms. Doesn't mean always, but psychotherapy can certainly help with the managing of stress symptoms. So it's interesting that medication first, and yet in the combination of psychotherapy was what I was finding in the research and generally heard. But again, how that research takes form and what it looks like is definitely very different when schizophrenia symptoms are on the table.
Absolutely. Well, and then KBI, I know you mentioned this earlier, but obviously if there's a crisis, usually these individuals are hospitalized. And I did see some like ECT maybe helpful as well. But I don't know I'm much more familiar with the research on that when it comes to depression.
I don't know. I had one client receive ECT treatment. And one of the things that we didn't like really quickly is, Jess, the reason why you haven't had much experience with this is because the onset is late adolescence to early 20s. It is very rare, for a child and or young adolescents. Usually at late adolescence is like 19, 20 to the early 20s is when that onset starts, which is exactly why Jess has not seen much of it, because we don't see this diagnosis with children.
And the ones I have seen were early onset, and they were late teenagers, like 17, 18. I don't have a good transition. I don't know how to go from 17 to 18 to Google Scholar Shorts. But we're just going to jump right in, because I know really we're excited for Cody to come on and talk about his experience. So we talked about substance use and schizophrenia. And so the question I'm going to pose to you all, how do you think cannabis use affects cognitive functioning in individuals with schizophrenia?
I'm going to lean towards not well, but maybe I'll be surprised, but I wouldn't think it's recommended or helpful.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it would hurt reality checking and hurt regulation.
Okay. So this study included two groups. For ethical purposes, they were individuals diagnosed with schizophrenia who were cannabis users and those who weren't.
They
weren't just giving marijuana to people. So in the cannabis user group, they had to use at least twice a week. And then the non-cannabis user group had never used cannabis currently or in the past. And then additionally, people were excluded if they drank more than 3 alcoholic beverages per week or used any other drug other than cannabis more than 4 times in their life. And I just wanted to put that out there before we get into the results, just because obviously that's good exclusion criteria. So the non-cannabis users performed better on tests of psychomotor function, attention, and verbal memory, while the cannabis users perform better on working memory, visual memory, and emotion regulation or recognition. And then the cannabis user group also performed better on executive functioning tasks, although that one was not a significant difference. And there was no association between age and sex and cognitive performance in individuals with schizophrenia. So in sum, the study found that cannabis use can impair cognitive domains of psychomotor function and attention, but can possibly improve the cognitive domains of working memory, visual memory, verbal memory, and emotion recognition.
Interesting.
I was shocked. Yeah, that's very shocking and interesting and nuanced, which is the most fascinating part of that research, is how much they broke that down. The working memory part, I mean, I don't even have a theory. And again, I'm not an anti-cannabis person by any means. Like, I think a lot of substances can have pros and cons. But the working memory is the thing that surprises me in there.
That surprised me as well. And it was interesting because they looked at cannabis because it is, according to this study, which I should have said came out this year, is one of the most heavily used substances among individuals with schizophrenia. And we know, as mental health professionals, cannabis use can cause hallucinations. So, you know, it's not generally recommended for people to use if they are, what's the word I'm looking for? Susceptible to hallucinations. But it may actually have some cognitive benefits. I have no theories either. I just thought it was a cool study.
Super interesting. That's why we love research. Surprises you.
Sometimes our poll results also surprise us.
They do.
It has happened.
So I did the polls this week. We asked 3 questions. So first question, have you or someone you know been diagnosed with schizophrenia? The options were yes, no, or unsure.
Probably no.
I'd say no.
It was no at 56%, but 30% said yes, which that shocked me. We didn't talk about this either, but lifetime prevalence is only 0.3 to 0.7%. So it shocked me. And then unsure was 14%. So yes, no was the highest, but I was shocked that so many people have known someone diagnosed with schizophrenia. Okay. When you hear the word schizophrenia, what comes to mind? Mm-hmm. Y'all have any guesses on what people might say?
I mean, I got a million, but...
Okay. Voices in your head, hearing voices, hallucinations, delusions, hallucination, medication, stigma, hallucinations, seeing, hearing things that aren't real, break from reality, paranoia. Some people wrote like certain people in their life, dissociating, psychosis, hallucinations was the main thing. Yeah. This is interesting. Personality splitting. So I think that kind of goes to some of the misconceptions, which we really didn't get into here. But it goes to show that, you know, there are a lot of misconceptions out there. Short story, The Yellow Wallpaper. Did any of you had to read that? I forgot about that until now.
I believe so.
I had to read that in grad school. Stigma. Yeah. So a lot of hearing voices, things like that. And then the last question I asked was, what are some common misconceptions you have heard about schizophrenia? They are violent. They hurt other people. Yep. Violence. They can never get better. Dangerous. Can't hold a job. Violent. Dangerous. Dangerous. Criminals. Yeah. I mean, dangerous and violent. Multiple personalities is a misconception. Mm-hmm. I like that that person said that going back to, crazy, dangerous, violent, no cure. This is, I mean, very uniform.
And that goes back to the stigma that is so badly associated with this diagnosis because of how it has been represented.
Mm-hmm. Like literally, I would say, I haven't counted, at least 95% of our answers were either dangerous, violent, crazy, uncurable. So, yeah. So those are the polls. Yeah.
Well, group members, we have Cody Green on the podcast, also known on social media as Schizophrenic Hippie. He's a 28-year-old with a diagnosis of undifferentiated schizophrenia. He's a motivational speaker and content creator with over 1 million followers on TikTok. He's struggled in the past with drug addiction, incarceration, and serious mental health issues. In order to be a better advocate and speaker, Cody has been trained as a peer support specialist, recovery coach, and suicide prevention specialist. Now, Cody shares his stories about his struggles and how to navigate through recovery, mental health issues, and life after incarceration. He chooses to pursue motivational speaking and mental health advocacy for schizophrenia awareness and drug recovery and second chance opportunities because he has dealt with these struggles in his own life. Thank you so much for joining us, Cody. We're so excited to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. I appreciate you guys bringing me on.
Yeah. So the first question that we ask our guests is, why post on social media? Like, what made you want to start posting on social media?
Yeah, I think for me, it was unintentional. You know, my wife downloaded TikTok when it was first becoming popular. Mm-hmm. And I remember being like, I am never going to download that stupid app. And as many of us did at one point, I think. And you know, she was sending me so many videos. I was like, you know what? I'll download it just so I can watch the video she's sending me a little bit easier. And from there, it became, well, you know, I'm starting to find videos I like. And then I started posting just the silly videos everyone was doing. And I got to about 300 followers. And I started wanting to talk more about my schizophrenia diagnosis, my passive addiction recovery. And I was doing a lot with peer support at the time. So I was finally getting to the point where I felt like I could tell these stories. And I did my very first schizophrenic story time, which is a segment I still do today. And I went to sleep with like 300 followers and I woke up with like 10,000 followers. And so I got a lot of messages from people saying, you know, my story made them feel less alone or it helped them better understand a friend or family member with schizophrenia. And that just, you know, it became my full-time thing. And I saw how needed it was for people to better understand schizophrenia. With all the good comments, I saw plenty of negative ones or misinformed ones that I realized, you know, as much as I know about schizophrenia because of my diagnosis and my mom's diagnosis, there was a lot of people who still needed to understand it better. And so I decided to kind of take on the role of trying to educate people more about it.
Yeah. Awesome. Wow. And kind of like I said to you before, like, I love your content. I love the way you talk about it. I love the way that you bring education and humor into it as well. Mm-hmm. Because it is, you know, very stigmatized and, like you said, very misinformed of what you know, truly is going on. So thank you. And then we have our second question, and there's only one right answer, I will say. And that is, are you team muffin or are you team donut?
Team donut, honestly. That's team muffin. Cool. Yeah, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, it's got to be donut. I mean,
Unfollow.
I felt confident in Cody. I'm just looking at the record. I just felt Cody's going to be team donut. Let's go.
No, that's to me. To me, that's a no-brainer, honestly.
I totally agree. Who would pick a muffin over a donut?
Especially if you have the choice. Don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with a good muffin. But if you have to choose, it's donuts all day, every day.
Absolutely.
That's a clip that just needs to hang in infamy. And we don't even need to have the debate anymore. We can't say it any better.
My father-in-law showed up with a dozen donuts and I didn't touch a single one.
That
just sounds like bad life decisions. And trust me, I've made a lot of bad life decisions, so
it's fine. It's fine. I'm full of them. It's all good. I'm here for it.
He's been right in with this podcast.
I'm here for it.
Somewhere I know K10 is celebrating. We got a win for Team Donut. But we're going to jump into these listener questions because we have people asking from all across the world, getting curious about your experience. I love how you're such a great advocate and you're transparent and talking about what your experiences have been like. So Kate from Michigan asks, when did you, Cody, first start showing signs of schizophrenia and what were those early signs?
So before I ever started having my own experience with schizophrenia, I actually have a mother who's diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. So I kind of recognized what those signs look like. Unfortunately, not in the moment because of delusion outweighing my critical thinking skills. But I, you know, was her caregiver until I went off to college. And then my first year of college is when I went through my own psychotic break. And so I was like 18, 19-ish. I don't know exactly when they started. The people around me said it was like right before I turned 19. Unfortunately, I wouldn't be diagnosed until I was roughly about 21. But the first symptoms I started experiencing were auditory and visual hallucinations. And then it very quickly went into paranoia and delusions. And so I was working full time. At the time, I was also going to school full time. I was unable to keep up with either of those. And that's kind of what led to, you know, my addiction and trying to self-medicate through, you know, what I was going through.
Appreciate you laying that out there because it's related to so many themes that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And then Caroline from Michigan, M from a galaxy far, far away, which I love, both asked a very similar question to you of, what would you tell someone who's either newly diagnosed or what would you tell your younger self in dealing with schizophrenia?
I think there's always two things that I wish I could go back and tell myself or that I do tell people that reach out to me that are newly diagnosed. And the first one is that although, you know, some people around you, including, you know, TV shows, movies, friends and family might tell you that your schizophrenia is a death sentence, it's not. With the right treatment and medication, you can definitely live a full functional life. And that's something that when I was first diagnosed, I didn't believe because of my mom taking, she went so long undiagnosed, almost 10 years. It had a lot of cognitive effects on her. And she, you know, she is fully disabled. She can't do anything she used to do. And it's really changed her life. And that's the only representation of schizophrenia I had ever seen besides movies and TV shows, and I think we all know that they do a less than stellar job showing what real life with schizophrenia is like. And then the other thing I always try to remind people is that you aren't alone, because it's so easy to feel very alone in a diagnosis like schizophrenia, especially for people who, like me, grew up in a really rural community. I lived in a town of 2,000 people. My graduating class was 40 people. And wow. So, wow. And so for me, it was the only person I had ever known with schizophrenia was my own mom. And, she was never in a really good place to, you know, talk about it or explain what she was going through because of how late, you know, she got diagnosed and got medication and treatment. Fortunately for me, that meant I could get treatment quicker when I did start showing symptoms because, with, you know, a lot of psychiatrists know that there's a genetic component to mm-hmm. schizophrenia. So once I started showing symptoms and finally reached out for help, I was actually able to get my diagnosis very quickly.
Yeah. I love that you started with the, like, hope aspect of things. Because before you hopped on, we do polls. And one of the things we asked this week was, what are some misconceptions? And a lot of people said that it's, you never can get better. Like, there's no treatment, there's no help. And so I appreciate you really starting with that. I mean, you're a lived example of that. But I think, to your point, if all people know is images like your mother or what's on TV, which we don't have to get into, it makes sense why people feel hopeless.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think for me, the reason I always start with that is because when it became really apparent to me that when I started making content early on, because I was doing well, and like most of the time I don't have symptoms, the first thought people had wasn't, oh my God, he's doing so well with medication. The first thought people had was, well, he's faking because he's okay sometimes and he's not in a psychiatric facility. So like that was, it's something I still struggle with today in my comment section, is people assuming that because I'm not constantly in an episode or not constantly hallucinating that I must be faking. And to me, that just really shows how much, like, one, how little people know about schizophrenia, but two, that we've created this idea that people with schizophrenia can never be normal, can never be functioning like a regular person. And so it became very clear very early on that that was something that I always had to mention, because it's one of the biggest misconceptions. I get a lot of different things, but that's definitely one of the biggest ones.
Yeah, misconceptions about severity and duration and just, TVs and movies have done a terrible job across representing mental health at large, but especially with schizophrenia. But this wasn't a question that a listener asked, but related to what you were saying in sharing your experience in that installation of hope, what have been the treatments for you that have made a difference?
So very early on, was very lucky that as soon as I sought help, and there is a couple year gap there where I was, you know, trying to self-medicate, I was too delusional to understand that something was wrong with me, even knowing what schizophrenia looked like through my mom's diagnosis. But as soon as I reached out to my wife and my mom and I said, hey, I think there's something wrong with me. At the time, I didn't know it was schizophrenia. I just recognized that I couldn't do what everyone else could do. So I'm very fortunate that they had a doctor and psychiatrist and everything like that lined up for me. They had resources ready to go because they had watched for several years me deny that I had any issues, but I couldn't hold a job. I couldn't get back to school, you know, so they had all those resources ready for me. And oh my God, what was the question?
you're on it. I was just curious, what have the treatments been?
Got. I finished my sentence and I realized I had no idea where I was going.
deal with that all the time.
Yeah. Same.
But they had a ton of resources ready to go for me. And so my primary care doctor got me into a psychiatrist, I think the same week, which in a small area that I'm in, that those times are like unheard of. They were awesome. They got me squeezed in and I was given a daily oral antipsychotic, and almost immediately I started seeing results. Over the couple course of about 6 years, I want to say, we tried a combination of several different antipsychotics on and off. It wasn't until about a year ago that I made the switch to a long acting injection. So instead of, you know, pills. I can go in, just get a shot. And that's been a life changer for me. It's been huge in my like ability to feel more free. I think people with schizophrenia, when we first start experiencing symptoms, we lose a lot of our freedom. You know, things that everyone can do, I can't do. You know, I couldn't drive because I was so symptomatic, and I couldn't travel like everyone. And so this medication in general gave me a lot of freedom back. But then switching to the long acting injection took away the like worry of like, oh my God, what if I forget my meds? And I do motivational speaking and comedy now. So I travel a lot, and I'm like, you know, what if I'm just, you know, TSA is not super cool about you bringing six pill bottles in a carry on. So, so it's like, it's just been a huge relief for me. But I also do monthly, even to this day, I still do therapy. I still do meet with my counselors. I pretty much stay on top of all of that, because the times in my life where I'm like, oh, I'm doing so well, I don't need these things anymore, you know, including, and this unfortunately happens a lot with people with schizophrenia. I did that early on with my medication too. And it's, you know, it's a nice thought, but I think that's why another reason why I spread awareness is to help people realize that schizophrenia is a lifelong illness. And if you're feeling better, it's because the things you're doing are working, not because you're getting better necessarily. And that's, it's unfortunate. You know, I don't want to have to be on medication the rest of my life. And I don't want to have to be, you know, I was going to say 20-year-old, but 30-year-old almost, taking a bunch of medication all the time. But I've also come to realize that in order for me to live the functional life that I'm living now, that's just, it's just a part of my life, like everything else.
I appreciate you sharing that back and forth experience that, like many of us, you know, living with any sort of ongoing mental health thing, like we run into, like you kind of, I'm going to quote KBI because you say it all the time, but sometimes we do fuck around and find out, and we notice how that changes our symptoms. I need to put like dash KBI after I quote
dash it. KBI.
2024. Yeah. Welcome to Group Therapy Pod.
Well, and that's something too, like you talk a lot about the injectables, and that is such an amazing resource for a lot of individuals who struggle with schizophrenia because of, you know, either that the not wanting to, like you said, I don't want to forget my meds. What if I, for some reason, pack them in my regular luggage and my luggage gets lost, and now I've lost 30 days worth of meds or 90 days worth of meds. And a lot of times that med compliance, even taking that oral dose, is really, really hard. And like you said, like, oh, I'm feeling good, I can just stop, versus like that 30 day dose, like it's there for 30 days. And usually if you can kind of get out of that, from clients that I've worked with specifically, you know, they can kind of get out of that and be like, okay, I'm just going to go to that appointment. I'm just going to go, cause I know I have to. But yeah, I also appreciate you sharing your story, because again, like just hearing this and talking about it and normalizing it, I think is so key.
Yeah, medication's a tough one, because I often say medication has as much of a stigma as my mental illness itself, it seems like, where, you know, I had a lot of people early on tell me, and it was part of the reason I didn't reach out for help for so long and try to self-medicate. People make it seem like you're less of a person for needing medication, or you're like not, you know, you're not quote unquote normal if you have to do that. And that was so, it's so frustrating looking back, you know, as like a full-time mental health advocate now, but it's also like it really played a role in me not getting the help I needed. And so I do a lot now talking about medication, and I've gotten a lot of pushback too, because I do a lot of collaborations with, you know, like big pharmaceutical companies talking about medication and treatment and awareness. Some people don't like that I do that and work with those companies, but I'm also someone who very early on, before I ever had the opportunity to work with these companies, promoted, you know, med awareness and med compliance and how important those things were. And so now it's nice to see that I'm getting less pushback on that, but it's still frustrating knowing that there are people out there who today could be getting medication, but someone in their life has talked them out of it, and their life is going to be worse off for at least a short period of time because of that. And that's really frustrating to me.
Oh, absolutely. Cody, reiterating everything Justin and KBI said, like, I appreciate you sharing so much. I had a follow-up question, if that was okay, because you mentioned you still do therapy, and we were talking before you hopped on, like, medication really is first line, but therapy can be helpful. And I was just wondering if you can talk a little bit about, like, specific things in therapy that have helped you or modalities that you've done, if you know, because I think as far as misconceptions, a lot of people don't really understand, like, how therapy could help somebody with schizophrenia.
Well, and I think getting to a place where I understood my emotions was really important, right? Because I think a lot of people, this is one thing where I am a little different with schizophrenia. A lot of people could walk into one of your guys' office and pretty well explain how they're feeling, what they're going through. Because of schizophrenia early on, I had a very hard time understanding my emotions, but also articulating thoughts in general. And so like communicating those things was very, very difficult, not just to a therapist, but to my friends and family. And it made my life a lot harder. And you see that. That's why a lot of people with not just schizophrenia, but for the, you know, for this conversation, I'm using schizophrenia. A lot of people with schizophrenia tend to isolate themselves. Mm. And that's the same with a lot of mental illnesses, because they feel like they can't communicate what they need. And it makes life very difficult and very frustrating. And so for me, getting to a point where I could talk about those things was a huge milestone for me. And it was only because my medication allowed me to have like moments of clarity, and I was able to start recognizing certain emotions and feelings in myself again, which for a long time I couldn't. You know, there was so much going on, and my brain was so focused on my delusions and my paranoia and my hallucinations that I really couldn't like identify like actual emotions that I was having. And once I got to a point where I could, there was a lot of trauma to unpack with being incarcerated, with being someone who had to be you know, brought into psychiatric wards, and like those experiences left way more trauma with me than I thought they would. It's still weird, like thinking that I was incarcerated, like it's been so long now. 2015 is when I got out. It's been almost 10 years. But that was my life for a long time. And I was undiagnosed when I went in. I was severely mentally ill. I sought out for help while I was incarcerated. And I was basically told that I was med seeking and no one would meet with me and they wouldn't help me get to speak to anyone. And so it wasn't until I got out of jail that I finally was able to reach out and get some assistance. And so that all was just a lot to go through. And then also, you know, I never as a kid went to therapy and talked about what it was like being a caregiver for a mother with schizoaffective disorder. My mom was a single mom trying to raise three kids while going through a psychotic break and struggling with addiction herself. And so my whole time in therapy has been unpacking not just what I went through as a child, but what I had to go through. It was like a cycle. You know, I went through this experience with my mom, and just when things were getting better and she got medication and treatment, I went through it myself. And you know, the frustration that came along with that. And there was a lot of anger that I had about, you know, the systems that weren't set up to help me and the people who watched me struggle. And so working through that was, not easy. And my therapist deserves a raise for sure. but we've gotten through a lot of it, you know, and we've dealt with, you know, a lot of the emotions that come with that. And like I said, the biggest thing was getting to a point where I could express those emotions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much nuance you're laying out there, which again, is just smashing stigma left and right, which is just so you, but it, related to some of that nuance, Janie from Australia asked, as a person with schizophrenia, I'm thinking you've had psychosis. How do you deal with trusting your perceptions when you are quote, well, without constantly questioning yourself?
Oh man, that's a super good question. off topic real shortly. I don't know why. I have a very large Australian following. So I don't know if there's a lot of people with schizophrenia in Australia or what, but it's like the second or third biggest country that follows me. Anyways, unrelated. I've seen that in my metrics on every single platform and I'm like, what's going on over there?
we need to get you over there.
Right? 100%. That's what I've been thinking. I'm like, I need to go do a tour over there or something. But no, it's a super good question. I think one of the curses, I want to say, of being a functioning person with schizophrenia is, even though I know I have schizophrenia, if I start having paranoia, delusions, or hallucinations, I still don't have control enough over my brain to always recognize that. So it's one of the most common questions I get when I post videos of myself having hallucinations. And that's going to lead into what I do is I have coping mechanisms to help me feel more comfortable day to day. But when I post those videos, people always ask, well, why wouldn't you know that someone shouldn't be in your house besides you or your wife? Like, why do you think there's someone there? And people think that I have such logical thinking in those moments. And unfortunately, even though most of the time I am very well, and I don't think most people speaking to me on the streets would know I have schizophrenia, when I do start having those symptoms again, delusion can still outweigh my critical thinking skills. I have set up different coping mechanisms and ways to identify that I'm having symptoms, and that makes me more comfortable to recognize them in the future. So one of those is my service dog. I have a service dog named Luna who recently has gone more viral than me, and it's fine. I'm not upset about it or anything. She helps me identify hallucinations, and that video has like 26 million views on TikTok right now. Like I said, not whatever. It's fine. I've only been doing advocacy for like 5 years, and she goes viral with her first video. But you can tell I'm not upset about it.
Not at all.
But no, she's been a huge help to me. And then I also have my phone technique I use, where pretty much constantly throughout the day I will pull out my phone, open up my camera, and see if the person I'm talking to is really there, which has led to some awkward conversations of me shoving my phone in people's faces who were really there. But but like those little things that I've incorporated in my daily life, it also allows me to like play back to see if later on throughout the day, I got smart glasses now too, so I can click a button and it records. And then if for some reason later in the day I was questioning that interaction, I can go on my phone, watch the interaction, and like it doesn't fix it in the moment, but it allows me to be like, okay, I was right. I was hallucinating in this moment. And it makes me more comfortable to be in public and, you know, do the things I have to do like a regular functioning adult. And so it's really difficult because, you know, with psychosis specifically, there's just a lot of things you can do preemptively, I think, to make yourself more comfortable and make sure that you have, you know, coping skills set up. And that's going to be a lot of working with your care team and identifying what helps you not only in the moment, but after the fact. Some people I know, I do this too, where I have a camera in my office too, because that's where I spend the most time. And I can always go back and replay if I think that I was having symptoms. And it's just building that foundation of like, I can trust these coping mechanisms, and that allows me to feel more comfortable.
And I think that's one of the things I love most too in your content is that you show that, like you show you using those coping mechanisms, because we all use coping mechanisms, and you have found something that, you know, helps you in a way to check in with reality and like what, I guess not reality, because I always say like that's still your reality, and that's something that I've that I've always said, but like to kind of say like I need to make sure that someone's not standing in my office with me right now, because we don't know. I need to make sure that someone's not walking behind me on this dark street. And maybe it is someone. Okay, I got to take care of that. But if it isn't, I'm able to check that and be like, okay. And I love that you showcase that, because some people don't realize, like, there are probably individuals who have been diagnosed that don't realize doing something as simple as that can be helpful.
Yeah, I know that since I've started sharing those techniques, I have doctors and psychiatrists reach out and they tell me that they've showed that to patients and patients have been able to implement that. And that's insane to me, you know, that techniques that I've used have gone on to like be implemented to help people in their everyday lives. And that's mm-hmm. like, you know, every time I want to quit doing content, it's a huge reminder to me that, you know, what I do and what other mental health advocates do is making a difference, even if we don't see it every day. And I think it can be frustrating with like negativity online. And so I try to really highlight some of those messages. I take a lot of screenshots and always go back and look through them because I think, you know, finding those things for yourself is so important, but being able to help other people have their own coping mechanisms. And I see, and I've seen you guys, even some of you guys do like, you know, tips and tricks for, you know, like anxiety, depression, stuff like that to help with day to day, just being able to function. And it can get really frustrating not feeling like a, you know, like everyone else, but having these things makes life a little more easy day to day. And that's really all I'm going for.
I love how you're interfacing with technology and you got, what are the glasses you got? What are they?
I have the, I actually have them on my desk right here. It's the Ray-Ban Meta glasses.
The Ray-Ban.
And so it's, yeah, they have the camera right in them and, they record audio too. So yeah, it's been super helpful. I posted a video with those like, a couple months back where, I was in the airport having symptoms and I was talking to someone who I wasn't sure was there. So I started recording it and then I didn't look at it in the moment. I didn't look at it until I got to my hotel. And then I realized, you know, that I had been hallucinating. And it's just like I said, it's just nice reassuring myself.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's just cool to hear that the technology, a lot of times we focus on just all the negative and certainly there are things that it can hold us back, but that there's real examples of how it's helping people.
Yeah.
So I love that you brought that up. Chris from Canada asks, Cody, have you had any experiences with cognitive symptoms such as attention, memory difficulties, or is that likely related to something else?
No. So this is something that I want to do more of on my channel. And I feel like I don't want to say I've added to this issue, but I feel like that a lot of what I've talked about have been the positive symptoms. And for anyone listening who doesn't know, positive doesn't mean good, which is what I thought when I first heard it. It means in addition to my personality, whereas negative symptoms and cognitive symptoms are something that I don't address a lot. So I recently have made posts talking more about negative and cognitive symptoms, a big focus on negative symptoms, you know, not being able to take care of myself, having issues with personal hygiene, stuff like that. Cognitive symptoms are something that I really struggle with. And I don't know why, but I feel like I've had a harder, like it's almost more embarrassing talking about negative and cognitive symptoms to me. And it's something that I need to deal with because, and don't worry, we're talking about it in therapy. it's one of those things where, you know, I've had a lot of time, a lot of difficulty, like talking about it. And it's a weird thing in my brain where I'm like, well, positive symptoms aren't my fault. You know, it's something that just happens to me. But for some reason, I feel like I'm somehow guilty for, you know, having a bad memory or not being able to take care of myself or not being able to take a shower every other day. And so it's like, I almost feel like it's a fault of my character. And that's made it really difficult for me to talk about those symptoms. But I do struggle a lot with the cognitive and negative symptoms. Cognitive, I have really a lot of issues with memory, both short and long term. I struggle a lot still with, sometimes I get aphasia and it makes it difficult to talk. And which for someone who's a motivational speaker is less than ideal. And then I also have a lot of issues with, sometimes when I'm having a lot of symptoms, I have difficult, emoting, like expressing my emotions. And for someone with an autistic wife, that's not great because she already has a hard time identifying my emotions. So, but it's all those little things that until recently, I didn't even realize were connected to schizophrenia. And that's super frustrating for someone who's been, you know, doing advocacy as long as me, to not realize that all of these things I thought were a fault in my character were really just more symptoms of schizophrenia.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. And I think it, thinking back to even what you were saying early on, you witnessed your mom, but you still didn't really necessarily see these symptoms in yourself. You've had this diagnosis for, you said you were 21 when you finally got the diagnosis.
Yeah, roughly.
Diagnosis.
Well, the diagnosis. Yeah, I've been having symptoms for like 10 years now.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you're still learning about the diagnosis in yourself, which is great.
I feel like one of the faults that, and I'm not trying to call out any specific creators, so no one clip this and like tag anyone in it. I think one of the issues that some mental health advocates face is they start thinking that they're experts in the field, or that they have a better understanding of their condition than anyone. And I've never claimed that. I literally just want to share my lived experience. And I think when some creators have gotten bigger, they stop learning more. They start just becoming an authority in understanding their illness or what they're going through. But I think there's so much we can never know about, mental illness, and especially schizophrenia. How can I claim to know everything when doctors and scientists still haven't been able to figure out everything about it, you know? So I'm trying to be very good at, always deferring and reminding people that I'm not a trained professional. I'm just someone struggling who wants to share about what I'm going through, to help remind people that, the information I'm giving, although some of it may be educational and may be helpful to others, I'm not someone who's, trained in psychiatry. I'm not someone who has the all-knowing authority on the topic. I just want to help people better understand my perspective. And like I said, I think that's where some mental health advocates have started missing the mark, and trying to act like they know for sure how to deal with things, what the coping mechanisms are, and forgetting that mental illness is a very individualized experience. And, what works for me isn't going to work for everyone else. It's also why I don't talk about brand specific medication when people ask me about medication, because I'm functioning really well, I get questions every single day. What meds are you on? They work so well for you. I want to get my brother, sister, dad on the same meds. And I have to constantly remind people, I'm like, brain chemistry doesn't work like that. There's a reason there's so many options out there. If we had one medication that helped schizophrenia, we wouldn't need all the other ones. So, I think just trying to realize that, I'm here to advocate, not to necessarily be the person out there who's giving all the information on schizophrenia, just based on my lived experience.
I love that so much. You said that so well too, that there's just always individual differences. I know we, as mental health professionals, even though we went to school for a long time, we'll have people ask us, how can I improve depression, anxiety, or anything? And it's like, well, it's tough, because exactly what you're alluding to, what works for one person might not work at all for another person. And you can always go back to, what does research say? But even in that, there's nuance.
Yeah.
And that nuance and context is something that I think some people just want like a answer, but we're just, as humans, we're just so much more complicated than that.
Exactly.
But kind of on the other side of the coin though, which goes to why advocacy and what you're doing is so important, I really like this question that April asked from New Mexico. Is there anything you'd want therapists or mental health professionals to know about what it's like to have schizophrenia?
I think on top of everything that's already known about schizophrenia, the positive, negative symptoms, everything like that, I think some doctors and, therapists, psychiatrists don't understand how frustrating it can be. And I'm not saying this sucks. I'm like, genuinely, my life has gotten to points where I've been so frustrated with every aspect of not just my, not just my mental illness, but how my mental illness is, taken care of, how my mental illness is viewed in the eyes of the public, how my mental illness, separates me from other people. And it's a lot to unpack. And I don't think we talk about that enough. I know even based on the schizophrenia advocates that I know personally, when I talk about that, it's really like a tough topic for people that like they, I don't think people have worked through a lot of that. And it's something that I actively work through because I identified it really early on that I was so upset and frustrated that, you know, I went several years without a diagnosis, and that when I did reach out for help when I was incarcerated, there was no help available. And so there was all these different things that made, getting care a barrier, and that should never be a thing. And so, especially if you're talking to someone who's, you know, doing well and, you know, in a position where they have, you know, more clarity, it's difficult because with clarity comes, you know, the realization that, you know, you were struggling for so long and you didn't get the help you needed. And, you know, some of the people around you wanted you to believe that there wasn't anything wrong with you. And so, frustration, I think, has been the hardest part of what I've dealt with, just realizing everything I went through, realizing that it could have been handled a lot better. And I mean, I think that's what makes advocates do advocacy, is starting to identify where those things are lacking. And, you know, every advocate I know has some sort of direct tie to mental illness. You know, when I do a lot of speaking to legislators in Wisconsin about serious mental illness, and it's, you know, anytime I'm there with other advocates, it's either someone directly who has a diagnosis, or it's friends or family members who had to watch them struggle. And unfortunately, a lot of people with schizophrenia might not ever get the treatment they need. They might end up taking their own life. They might end up, you know, dying on the street homeless. And those are very real statistics when less than 1% of people in the United States have schizophrenia, but we make up over 20% of the homeless rate. And that's just diagnosed. I would argue it's probably a lot higher. You know, those things are really frustrating. And so it's trying to identify that and figure out how I can help change it, you know?
Absolutely. And we have no doubts in all the ways that you're involved that you are changing it. And we have a long way to go. Yeah. It's easy. Sometimes I think about what like mental health discussions I experienced in the 90s, like growing up, like how non-existent it was, man. At all. And yeah. I'm like, oh, we've come a long way. But then you have these nuanced conversations. You're like, yeah, we got fucking miles and miles. We got miles and miles to go.
We still got some work to do here, boys.
Yeah. There's plenty to be done. We got time for a couple more questions here. Anonymous asks, and again, I like thinking about this. I know we ask this in a lot of different ways on our episodes, but like, if there's someone in your life who has schizophrenia, it's a family member, it's a friend, it's a partner, how can I support them?
Yeah, that's a super good question. I think it does come down, like we had just talked about, to individualized care, better understanding the person and what they need. I am really pumped. I'm doing a video about this actually with Gabe Howard. He's like one of the biggest bipolar advocates. And if you guys ever want him on, let me know, because I know the guy pretty well. But he's a huge, you know, bipolar advocate. He hosts the Inside Bipolar podcast and Inside Mental Health podcast on Healthline Media. And we're going to do a video about this from the point of view of a schizophrenic person and a bipolar person, how to better help a friend or family member with schizophrenia. So that's because as we're both speakers, we get that question so often, and we actually have we have an idea of how we want to set it up so that we can, one, make sure people understand it is individualized, but two, there are some things you can be doing to help your the person you're caring for. So an example, just one example, and we'll have a ton more, but the one thing that my wife and my mom did, like I said, 2 years I was struggling with undiagnosed schizophrenia and struggling with addiction. That entire time, what they were doing was preparing resources, making sure that if I did reach out, all of those things were ready and available. And that's what got me into treatment. That's what got me my diagnosis. That's what got me medication so quickly. And the thing we see and the thing I hear a lot as an advocate and speaker is people will tell me, well, my son did reach out, but because of wait times, because of, you know, we didn't have everything put in place, by the time we had the resources, they were no longer interested. People with schizophrenia and serious mental illness can have moments of clarity where they realize something's wrong and they can reach out. We need to make sure we're not missing those moments, because those could be the only moments they reach out. And I'm someone who, you know, there's a lot of conversation about forced treatment and forced care. I'm not someone who really supports the idea. And so I understand that in some severe measures, it's the only choice. But I'm always looking for ways to avoid that, because it's trauma for the person going through it. It often ends in bad situations with police and, you know, with EMTs. And like, it's an unpleasant experience for everyone involved. So getting people the help they need in those moments of clarity is crucial. And I think that's a lot of what, you know, we want to talk about. And then getting back to also, it is an individualized thing. And what, you know, what we look at for some people might not always work for other people, but finding things kind of in the middle that may work for most people is going to be, you know, a big part of making sure that we can help friends and family members that are struggling.
Yeah, I'm stoked for the collab when it drops. You know, we'll all be sharing it, posting it, putting it everywhere in our stories and otherwise. But yeah, it sounds so helpful, because I couldn't agree more. There's always this middle ground of people having the knowledge, the awareness, and general resources. And yes, and still knowing, yeah, there's going to be individual differences, but a lot of people just have no idea, you know, where to start. So I love that you're participating in that collab with another very stigmatized mental illness, bipolar disorder.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I know before we transition out of here, you're involved with so many different things. You're doing a bit of comedy. Are there any projects, upcoming things besides this collab that you'd like to shout out and let our listeners know about?
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, the comedy has been a big thing for me. I think that's been also funny enough that I'm on this podcast talking to you guys about it. It was something my therapist recommended, because I can't go a whole session without cracking jokes about my mental illness.
Yeah.
So they were literally like, hey, have you thought about maybe trying stand-up comedy? So that's been a huge thing for me. And you know, as silly as it sounds, it's been a very healing thing for me. As a, you know, full-time motivational speaker, I love sharing my story and being able to help people better understand schizophrenia. But like we had talked about earlier, it comes with a lot of trauma. And this allows me to do that and allows me to share the same story, but also do it in a way that I think connects with people who might be too nervous to look into schizophrenia or talk about schizophrenia. But it also lets me deal with it in a way that I never thought possible. So you know, my comedy has been a huge thing for me. I am also working on a book right now, which is super exciting. A publisher reached out about writing a book about mental illness and mental health in the workplace. So that's been crazy. And then of course I'm always doing motivational speaking, and all of that information collectively is on my website, codygreen.com.
Awesome.
Well, I love that. You know that I love your humor. I think I've slid into your DMs with jokes and continued the humor off comment sections, but I do love it. I love what you're doing. I thank you so much for coming on the podcast, talking about your story, sharing it from just a different lens, because for us, we're coming at it, we're three therapists. Right? We're coming at it from the other side, and to really hear about your lived experience and talking about the ways that you cope and manage has not only been eye-opening and insightful for myself, I can probably say that for Jess and Justin, as well as for our listeners, specifically just breaking down that stigma, because as we heard in our poll section, right? That there are just still so much stigmatization. There's still so much stigmatization around it and discrimination that comes with it. And so, you know, the more we talk about it, the more we pull back that veil and kind of show that true side, it's helpful. But yeah, thank you to everyone for joining for this week's episode of Group Therapy. Make sure to rate, subscribe, review, leave a comment, put it in the group chat, and we will see you next week in Group Therapy. Bye.
Bye.
Peace.